I invite you to take your Bibles and turn with me to Philippians chapter 1, first chapter of the letter to the church at Philippi, Philippians 1. If you are using the Bibles here in the auditorium, it's on page 817. Appreciate the message of the songs. I've been struck recently and just with all that has gone on in our ministry with the number of songs that conclude with an eternal focus, that emphasize the brevity of life and the importance of preparing for eternity and living in such a way that the Lord is glorified. I want us to consider this morning the importance of investing and evaluating our life for the glory of God. One of the classes that I remember from my public high school was a reading class. All we did was read books. We got to choose the books. We would go into the classroom and just read during that time. There was no homework, but you could read outside of class and read whatever you wanted. And your grade was based on the number of pages you read. I liked the class because it really did encourage reading, and I could also read for other classes. But one of the books that I ended up reading was this book by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, The Gulag Archipelago. I wish I could say that I picked it up because I was really interested in the geopolitical realm and the issues that were going on. But frankly, it was a very long book. The book was about 700 pages. And the teacher said that she would count it as 1,000 pages if we read it. And I said, well, that kind of bonus is too good to pass up. My grade is based on how many pages I read. I get an extra 300 if I read this book. I can do that. It was a book that Solzhenitsyn told about his experience and it really exposed the forced labor camps, the secret police, the brutal treatment, the religious persecution, and deaths that took place under the Soviet society and the USSR. And I remember, while I read it because I could get extra pages, I remember being sobered as I was exposed to the hostility leveled against people just for being Christians, as he talked about those who suffered for their faith. And today I see that book as really a cautionary story for our country. Those who think that socialism is a good thing. That when you have a system that is anti-God in its foundation, in its philosophy, that is not going to go well. And then when you deny human depravity on top of that, it only intensifies the evil in a society. But it was not an easy read. So while I was reading it to get these extra pages, it was not an easy read. Solzhenitsyn did not sensationalize the brutality of the communist regime, but neither did he hide it. He described the rampant, unjust imprisonments, the abuse in the court systems, the inhumane treatment in the prisons, and the various forms of torture that would be used. He talked about the hopelessness of the conditions that came. And Solzhenitsyn made the statement, the only way to survive in prison is to abandon all expectation in this world and live for the next. Now, while Solzhenitsyn saw that as the necessary mindset to survive the Russian prison, the Gulag, I think that mindset really serves us well as Christians. It ought to set our expectations for living and to focus on the next world, that we are citizens of heaven. If you've trusted Jesus Christ, if your expectations are in this world, you are going to be disappointed. People will let you down. Situations are not going to go as we desire. Politicians will let us down. But if our goal is to live for the next world, then not only can we survive, but we can thrive because we're living for the Lord. And I think that really is the focus that Paul voices here in Philippians. This is his outlook. If you have your Bibles open to Philippians 1, follow with me as I begin reading in verse 19. Philippians 1, beginning in verse 19. For I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and my hope that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but with all boldness, as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if I live in the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor. Yet what I shall choose, I cannot tell. For I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy of faith, that your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again. In these verses, we see Paul's perspective on what came into his life as he is in some difficult circumstances, but he views those through the eye of ministry, a focus on eternity. He views relationships in the context of the gospel going forth. In fact, we see that in all of this, and in fact in verse 27, he admonishes the believers in Philippi that they need to conduct themselves in a way that is worthy of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That everything Paul saw went through the lens of how does this impact the gospel. He really did not have the expectations in this world other than to live for the glory of God. And when you have a life's purpose that seeks to glorify Christ, it will impact all aspects of your life, of your existence. And that's what I want us to consider from primarily verse 20 of Philippians 1 this morning. The first thing that we see is seeking to magnify Christ will direct your anticipation. Notice what Paul says, according to my earnest expectation. He said, I'm looking forward. I am anticipating. I have a desire that is still in front of me. The picture that he's using here is really of a runner that is stretching their neck out to cross that finish line. That his look is straight ahead. In fact, he's using the analogy in that word that he's not getting distracted by looking around. He said, I'm looking ahead. My earnest expectation. You know, sometimes we see video of a runner that they think they're way out in front, and as they get close to the finish line, instead of stretching forward, they start looking to the crowd. They start maybe even waving. And you've probably seen videos of when somebody starts to do that and somebody passes them. They don't cross the line first because their attention turned elsewhere. Paul doesn't want to be looking in the wrong direction. That's why he says, according to my earnest expectation and my hope, I'm going to keep pressing forward. The truth is, Paul had many opportunities to have his attention distracted. I mean, Paul is writing from prison. Philippians is one of the prison epistles, a prison letter, which is interesting because the theme of it is joy. He's writing from prison, so his ministry opportunities have been limited. He can't be out preaching like he would want to be. He speaks of individuals. In fact, if you want to look at verses 15 and 16, he talks about people who are actually preaching the gospel to try to make it worse for him. He says in verse 15, some indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambitions, not sincerely, supposing to add my affliction to my chains. There were actually people that said, you know what, if we preach the gospel, it'll be worse for Paul. Let's preach. What a great motivation. That somehow they thought, Paul is in prison because the gospel's being preached. If we preach the gospel more, it's going to be worse for him, and we want it to be bad for Paul. And how discouraging would that be? And yet, what was Paul's attitude? You know, if Christ is preached, I rejoice. How could he say that? He was focused on the gospel. He was focused on what others were saying. In fact, if you look back at verse 12, he says, I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. Paul said, what's happened to me has furthered the gospel. What a focus. What has happened to him? He's in jail. He's in jail for preaching the gospel. And he doesn't say that in spite of what's happened to me, the gospel has gone forth. He said, actually, what has happened to me has advanced the gospel. And I spend a little bit of time here because I think sometimes we see our circumstances and view ourselves as we're just kind of the victims of what happens. Because Paul's focus was serving Christ. He said, you know what? God's used what has happened to me to advance the gospel. Do we really see that what has happened to us in the last year and what is coming, that God is still in control? He's not wringing his hands saying, you know, how can I make this work together for good? For those who love me. What an outlook to have, that all things work together for good to those who love God, or as verse 6 of this chapter says, being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will continue to complete it until the day of Christ. So he says, I have this hope. According to my anticipation and my hope, that forward confidence. In fact, in 1 Timothy 4, verse 10, he said, for this end we both labor and suffer reproach because we trust in the living God. Paul said, the reason I work and the reason I'm willing to suffer is because I'm trusting God. He, in essence, has said, you know what? My expectations are not in this world. That if I work really hard, people will be nice to me. That if I work really hard, I'll be noticed for that. No, he said, I'm living for the next world, that Christ will be glorified. And so he says, so according to my earnest expectation and my hope. So what was Paul hoping for? That he would get released from prison? That he'd finally get his freedom back? That the discomfort would be removed and that he wouldn't be facing the difficulties? No, he actually says, my earnest desire, my hope, is that I would be ashamed of nothing. And so the second thing we see is that seeking to magnify Christ will determine what we try to avoid. Paul wasn't saying, okay, if I get out of this jail, I'm going to do everything I can not to have it happen again. I'm going to try to make sure that people are nice to me. No, he says, he actually states his hope two ways. First, he says that he would not be ashamed, and secondly, that Christ would be exalted. You know, none of us likes to be disappointed. None of us likes to be embarrassed, to be ashamed. The idea here is to be put to shame or disgrace, to cause shame. Paul's concern was not his current circumstances. It wasn't that he had lost his freedom. That really was not his big concern. In fact, he wasn't even concerned about his life. As we read, he's wrestling with, you know, to abide with here is probably more needful, to depart. If I could depart, I'd be with Christ. And he actually says, I'm not sure which to choose, which really opens an interesting question. Had the Lord maybe given him the option? As an apostle, had God said, Paul, what do you want? Do you want to continue to minister? Do you want to come home? Because he makes an interesting statement. He says, if I live in the flesh, then I have the fruit of my labor. He said, but in verse 23, he said, I'm hard pressed between the two. And he said, I don't really know what to decide. You know, for most of us, we don't have a choice in that decision. Unless it's just give up. But ultimately, Paul said, I'm confident that I'm going to remain because that's what you need. He said, what I want is to go be with Christ. But what is more needful is to remain. And so his focus was not that he would be ashamed because, well, you know, people will now view him as an ex-con. You know, Paul, you were in prison. Yeah, it wasn't the first time, won't be the last. But that wasn't his concern. He wasn't concerned with what people would think. His concern was not that he had been arrested or that he had been beaten. His greater concern was he didn't want to invest his life in something that didn't matter. He said that he would be ashamed if he wasted his life, if he fell flat on his face instead of crossing that finish line. As he stretched forward to lose footing, if you're reading through the Bible this year in Mark chapter 8, just last week's reading, Jesus said when he had called the people to himself, he said to his disciples, "Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous, sinful generation, of him the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in glory with his Father and holy angels." What a statement. If we're ashamed of him in this adulterous and sinful generation, that is our world today. Immoral and wicked. So don't be ashamed. Don't fall on your face. Paul said he would be ashamed if he lived for those things of this world. In fact, in Philippians chapter 3, verse 19, he mentions those who live by their fleshly desires. Their God is their belly. They serve their desires. They glory in what they should be ashamed of because they are focused on earthly things. Paul said, "I don't want to fall." So the third thing he says is seeking to magnify Christ will inspire you to consistent courage. He said, "But with all boldness, as always, so now also, with confidence." Literally, that courage, that boldness. Paul said, "This is what I want, that internal strength that he would live for Christ or die for Christ, and either way would be fine because his focus was Christ." See, Paul was consumed with Christ. And because of that, he could be courageous. He was courageous if he stood before kings. He was courageous if he sat in a prison. So when he was beaten and cast into the prison at Philippi, as the church was being established, and now he's writing back to that church, they sang. Paul and Silas in that prison sang, and the jailer comes in after the earthquake, and he's saved. I mean, the charter members of the church at Philippi, a prison guard, demon-possessed, former demon-possessed slave girl, Lydia, the seller of purple, a businesswoman, this was their church. And Paul is writing back and saying, "Look, I don't want to be ashamed. I want to boldly serve." He was supported by the prayers of believers. He mentions that in verse 19 where we began, that it will turn out for my deliverance through your prayers. But he also wrote to the church at Ephesus and said, "You need to pray for me." He said, "Pray on my behalf that I would make known with boldness the mystery of the gospel." And when I read that in Ephesians 6, I'm struck because I don't think of Paul as somebody who lacked boldness. But it wasn't Paul. It was the Lord working in his life. And so he said, "I want to be consistent. As always, so now also." And when you read of Paul's life, you see that consistency. I mean, in Acts chapter 20, he's been arrested again. He had gone to the synagogue in Jerusalem, and he gets arrested. But as he's going, he tells the leadership at the church of Ephesus that when he's going, he's not quite sure what's going to happen. But he says this, he's anticipating chains and tribulations. He said, "I think when I go, from what the Lord has revealed to me, I can anticipate that I'm going to be arrested. And it's going to be a problem." But then he says in verse 20 of Acts 20, or verse 24 of Acts 20, he says, "But none of these things move me, nor do I count my life dear to me, so that I may finish my race with joy." He keeps stretching forward. He said, "The fact that I'm going to face chains and tribulation are not going to dissuade me. They're not going to turn me aside." How could he be consistent like that? He focused on Christ. Folks, we can do the same thing. This isn't just for Paul. This is for us, that we can be courageous, that with boldness we can serve the Lord. But we don't know what's coming. You know, we like to make decisions based on information. We live in the information age, and I want to get all the information and make a wise decision. And the one piece of information that I want that I can't get is what's going to happen tomorrow. Well, if I just knew that. So I have to serve the Lord faithfully with what I know today. And that's really walking by faith. If I knew what was going to happen by tomorrow, I don't need faith. I can walk by sight. And we talk about living by faith and we sing about it. Do we actually do it? See, Paul is saying that I want this boldness, that he would be consistent now. Can we see how God can use the circumstances, the situations, the experiences that we had last year, that maybe he's preparing us for what's coming this year? That we would be bold? None of it caught him off guard. So that, fourthly, that we would seek to magnify Christ, it will motivate us with an ultimate purpose. That Christ would be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. That he wants Christ to be seen in him. The idea of magnification. You know, we look through a lens to see something. If it's a telescope, it's the idea of increasing the size. To magnify means to increase the apparent size of an object, especially by the means of a lens or an instrument or a device, or we could say by life. Paul said, I want that object to appear bigger to people by my life. It carries the idea of showing the right importance, of seeing Christ for who he is, that he would be glorified. You know, Christ is not important in the lives of most people in our culture today. Even if they talk about him, it's not really that he's important. Usually when his name is used, it's used as a swear word, a punctuation mark. Paul said, I want them to see Christ as large, as important, that he would be glorified. You know, a telescope takes something that's distant and brings it near. It's large, but it seems so small at a distance. And you look through that telescope and it looks much larger. Or a microscope that takes something that is small and makes it larger. Is your life a life that makes Christ seem near to those to whom he's distant? Or they see him large because in their mind he's small. Paul lived in such a way that people saw Christ in him. So as I mentioned in Acts 20, he's telling the church at Ephesus, the leaders, he said, I'm going to Jerusalem. I don't know what's going to happen, but I think it's change and tribulation. And sure enough, he goes into the synagogue, he gets arrested. He sits in Caesarea for several years, finally appeals to Caesar, and so he gets sent by ship to go to Rome. And in the process of this, the weather turns. And so they're on an island in Acts chapter 27, and it's not really a nice place to spend your winter. You know, they hadn't come to the valley of the sun. And so the captain of the ship and the owner of the ship say, you know, this isn't really where we want to spend our winter. There's nicer places. And when the weather seemed to change, they said, let's get out of here. And Paul warned them. He said, this is not a good idea. If we leave, it's going to go poorly. But, you know, Paul's a prisoner. The pilot of the ship, the owner of the ship said, we want to go, and so they don't heed Paul's counsel. And what happens, as you read chapter 27 of Acts, they end up in a terrible storm to the point that they don't think anybody's going to live. And Paul doesn't stand up and say, see, I told you so. You should have listened to me. None of this would happen. But no, you had to do it your way. Well, too bad. That's not his attitude at all. He stands up and says, take heart, men. For I believe God that it will be just as he told me. What did God told him? Paul, you're going to go to Rome. You're going to stand before Caesar. You will be brought before him. And so he said, look, take heart. Now, what an interesting situation, because Paul was in the mess that he was in because of other people's bad decisions. He was in that situation because they had disregarded his counsel. But rather than sulking, he encourages them. He says, look, take heart. The Lord has spoken to me. Let me tell you, we will live. Do you think that Christ became magnified in the eyes of those sailors? Paul went from being a prisoner on the ship to being the key voice of the captain's advisory council. Even the centurion who was in charge of Paul would listen to Paul. So when the sailors started to make bad decisions, they said, we're gonna lower a boat, we're taking off. And Paul said, look, unless they remain with this ship, they will not live. And the captain listens to Paul instead of the sailors. How did that happen? Christ was magnified. Even the centurion is listening to Paul as Paul tells him. And so when the other soldiers want to kill the prisoner so they won't escape, the centurion wants to keep Paul alive and says, don't kill any of them. Christ was being magnified. And notice what he says, that Christ would be magnified in my body. That was the vehicle. Paul didn't worship the physical. He didn't live for the physical. He had presented his body as a living sacrifice. Or as we saw last week in 2 Timothy chapter 4, he was being poured out like that drink offering upon the altar. He said, my life is being spent in service. Folks, that's the call for all of us. If you are a Christ follower, you are to be a living sacrifice, not a well-preserved specimen of humanity. Our goal is to serve. And so Paul said, my body is a vehicle for ministry. And when you think of what he went through, and I mentioned it again from 2 Corinthians, he lists the number of times he had been beaten, he had been stoned, he had been left for dead, the shipwrecks, and all of this that had gone on. I think Paul probably had some pretty noticeable scars. I mean, if he wanted to tell you his experience, he could probably say, well, this one came in Philippi. Oh, and this one was when that rock hit me. And without a plastic surgeon, he probably had some pretty significant marks. And the truth is, we don't face that kind of persecution yet. But you know, there are times we're cut by words, unkind deeds. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely. But does it cause us to turn away? We say, you know, I was serving the Lord, but then they said this, or they didn't do this, or I'm out of here. If your hope, expectations are in this world, you're going to be disappointed. If they're in people, even people who try to do right will let us down. And yet here Paul is in a Philippian, or he's writing to the church of Philippi, he's sitting in jail, and he says, there are actually people who are trying to make it worse for me, and I'm rejoicing because they're preaching. He wasn't upset. He was excited. Heard Kevin Bowder make the statement, how much would our church be liberated if we could get past our personal feelings when our feelings get hurt and just be concerned that the gospel is going forward? Instead of looking at what is it about me, how is this helping Christ? I, when I read this, I think, okay, these men who were preaching, they were preaching the clear gospel, because Paul would give no line to those who would be preaching a false gospel. But he said, you know what? If Christ is being preached, I'm not worried about what it does to me, because it's not about me, it's about Christ. Folks, can we get that focus? He said, some indeed preach Christ of envy and strife. That was their actual motivation. They want to add affliction to my chains, and I rejoice because Jesus is being preached. Can we say that? See, Paul was focused on Christ rather than his feelings. So often when our feelings get hurt, and I speak personally, I have to examine and say, you know what? It's really injured pride. Let's focus on Christ. Let's do that. So 1 Corinthians 6:19 says, or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? You are bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. Don't allow our spirit to be hurt. Paul had the physical scars, but his spirit was also one that said, I'm going to glorify God. So how can we apply this personally? First of all, do you have that personal relationship with Jesus Christ? If you aren't sure of your relationship with Christ, you're not going to have the confidence that we're speaking of this morning. You're not going to have the confidence that Paul said. You can't say, I'm abandoning hope here. I'm living for the next world other than in a fantasy world. And faith is not faith in faith, as we've mentioned. It's faith in a person, the person of Jesus Christ. The person and cross work that he died for me personally. See, before his salvation, Paul was a religious man. But he didn't know Jesus. In fact, on that road to Damascus, when he was confronted and he said, who are you? He said, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. Do you know Jesus personally? Have you turned from your sin? Have you come to that point where you realize because of the glory of God, the sinfulness of your sin has separated you from him, and that's why Christ came. And he died to pay that penalty. And that by faith alone, you have turned from your sin and put your trust in the finished work of Christ alone. See, Paul's confidence was in Christ alone. He was not earning acceptance, but he was serving Christ, and that's what consumed his life. So the second thing we see is, we can ask is, do you recognize specific areas where the Lord's working in your life? What areas are you needing to grow? Where is the Lord working? Because of what's taken place, how are we growing in him? Do you serve him? Can you say my body is that instrument for service to the Lord? Do you serve him in your spirit? Are the fruits of the spirit evident? The third thing we see is, are you striving to grow in your faith and to avoid that which dishonors the Lord? In Romans 10, verse 11, it says, whoever believes on him will not be put to shame. Paul wasn't going to come to the end of his life and say, oh, my trust was in something that will not save me. I remember hearing on the radio years ago, there was an Eastern religion spiritist who had made the statement that God was the biggest myth that had ever been foisted upon man. And that day, they were announcing that this person had died. And the person on the radio made the statement, today he finds out whether he was right. He found out that he was ashamed. He had put his trust in a philosophy that failed. Paul said, I know whom I believe. And so he was able to live in a way that faith was there. And then he was not going to dishonor the Lord. It's that faith in the person of Jesus Christ that causes us to take heart in the midst of the storm. Or 2 Timothy 1:12, Paul wrote again, for this reason I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I'm not ashamed. For I know who I have believed, and I'm persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. So then we see as well that in what ways do those around you see an increasing Christ-likeness displayed in your daily living? Are we showing forth Christ? Do my priorities demonstrate Christ-like thinking? You know, if I live for comfort before serving the Lord, then I'm not like Christ. If I live for prosperity before God, I'm not like Christ. If I put safety before God, I'm not like Christ. If I put family before God, I'm not like Christ. And none of those things are wrong. It's not wrong to desire comfort, prosperity, safety, family. Those are good gifts from God. But they should not become our God. They should not be what drives our life. And if I bow before the altar of comfort, prosperity, safety, or even family, I am in a dangerous place because God's working to make me like his son. And that was not the spirit of Jesus Christ. God's goal as his child is that I would magnify his son. And he's not going to prosper that which interferes with his purpose or bless his competition. Therefore, folks, this is why it's so important that we evaluate and invest our lives, that Christ would be seen in our life, in our home. You know, do we exemplify Christ-likeness in our attitude toward our children, toward our spouse, toward our co-workers, in our neighborhood? Would people say, you know, there's something different about you? You know, when pressure comes, you handle it differently than the world. That Christ would be magnified. That the voice of the Lord would be magnified through our lives. You know, there are certain times that an amphitheater will magnify sound. Well, does the voice of the Lord come forth in our lives? Do we speak his love, as we read in John 15? Do we speak with grace and truth? We live in an angry, frustrated, hostile world. Oh, that we would show the truth and grace of Christ in our lives. Is Christ seen in my attitude, in my spirit, in my emotions? And then a fifth area we can ask, do you demonstrate courage and exhibit activity in things that matter for eternity? Do we show forth Christ? One commentator said, only courageous living exalts Christ. He didn't say arrogant living, but courageous. That we would say, you know what, I'm going to serve the Lord. Here I stand. And as persecution comes, are we able to keep our gaze on Christ, that we live for eternity? So I would ask, with all this happened in this past year, how is the Lord preparing us for what's coming? What if our culture begins to view our biblical values, our biblical principles, our biblical positions as toxic? Our position on marriage, on sexuality, on gender, male and female, created he them. As Joe Biden has said, on the very first day he's in office, he's going to push forward the transgender mindset. They're going to be putting things into place. Do you think we may see persecution coming? Don't let the cultural science deniers convince you otherwise. God created male and female. It's part of the image of God in man, and I believe that's why it's under attack. A sixth question we can ask, what consumes your thoughts and energies and your ambitions? Do we get distracted by lesser things? It's so easy to have our attention shifted as we're trying to stretch forward and then to turn aside. Keep that eternal goal before us. Paul was more concerned about his character than whether he would do well in the courtroom. His focus was on not being ashamed, not on being acquitted. He said, whether I live or die, I want Christ to be magnified. Oh, that we would say, I want to be right. I want to do right, not that I want to be proved right. Commit to serve Christ, to serve him with our body, regardless of the cost. To live in such a way that we are a living sacrifice, holy. We can be holy. And that is acceptable to the Lord. And so the seventh question I would ask is, how do you state your life mission? How would you sum up your life goal? I think I've mentioned before, but some time back, Pastor Malone challenged our college students in one of our IBCS chapels that they ought to be able to state their life mission in 15 words or less. Their purpose for living. He said, you ought to be able to put it in one sentence of 15 words or less. And I was challenged by that. And I took his statement and I thought on that. And I thought of that statement in light of my life verse. And as I meditated on it, I worked through how could I sum up what I want to be my life mission. And I came to this from Philippians 1:20, which is my life verse. That I may courageously magnify Christ in my everyday life until my death. That I want that to be my goal. That this picture is currently on the lock screen of my iPad. that when I open it up, that I may courageously magnify Christ in my everyday life until my death. Do I get it right? No. I fail every day. But if I don't have a point of evaluation, then how will I invest my life? What is your point of evaluation? Be a better person? Be a better Christian? What does that mean? We have to be specific. And I would encourage you, what is your mission in life? Last week I asked, you know, what do you want written on your tombstone? You know, if I were to take it from this, it's something like Christ was magnified. But living with a goal before us. Paul said that whether I live or die, that he would be magnified. And so he could say, for to me to live is Christ, to die is gain. Because if I die, I'm with Christ. If I live, I serve Christ. And he says, and then I have the fruit of that. Folks, where are we investing our energies? Oh, I'm too tired for church. I'm too tired to serve. You know, there are a number of needs in our ministry. We've lost some faithful servants. God takes his workmen home, but his work goes on. So how would you state your life mission? Are you investing for eternity? Can we say with Paul, to live as Christ, to die as gain? Do you know him personally? Are you living for him today? Let's bow for prayer together.